It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. 15 states and U.S. territory all held their Super Tuesday primary elections yesterday. After almost all Republican primary elections went Donald Trump's way, Nikki Haley announced this morning that she's suspending her campaign for president. Haley had been Trump's final remaining major challenger for the Republican nomination. As we're going to hear in a bit, she didn't endorse Trump, not yet anyway. We're going to talk about the results and what they mean for Trump, Biden, and the campaigns in the months to come. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. What are you taking away from Super Tuesday? Were you a Nikki Haley supporter? How are you reflecting on her suspending her campaign? How do you plan to vote now? And what do you think about a Biden-Trump rematch? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Charlie Sykes was a longtime conservative talk radio host for WTMJ in Milwaukee. He's founder and now former editor-at-large of The Bulwark, a conservative political journal. He's a columnist for MSNBC, author of the book How the Right Lost Its Mind. Charlie, welcome back to Central Time.
It is good to be with you.
So it looks like a Trump-Biden rematch. I want to hear your reflections on how we went from January of 2021, the Republican heads of both chambers of Congress saying calling Trump's behavior disgraceful. That's Mitch McConnell there. Now Mitch McConnell endorsing him today. How do we get from there to here and Trump's the almost sure thing nominee?
Well, I'm glad you put it that way, because it's easy to sort of get numbed by this, to think that everything was inevitable. But in fact, it obviously wasn't inevitable. I mean, it is rather extraordinary to think about the last several years, because Republicans have had several off ramps from Donald Trump. And January 6th was certainly the most dramatic. It looks for a moment as if they would take it. But here we are. The Republican Party just simply cannot quit Donald Trump. And apparently this is what the Republican base wants. And what's left of the Republican establishment was not able to mount any sort of meaningful resistance, as you see from even Mitch McConnell, who came very close to voting to convict Donald Trump, now today endorsing him for another term as president.
Let's give a listen out of former South Carolina governor, ambassador to the UN, Nikki Haley, suspending her campaign this morning, speaking in Charleston.
In all likelihood, Donald Trump will be the Republican nominee when our party convention meets in July. I congratulate him and wish him well. I wish anyone well who would be America's president. Our country is too precious to let our differences divide us. I have always been a conservative Republican and always supported the Republican nominee. But on this question, as she did on so many others, Margaret Thatcher provided some good advice when she said, quote, never just follow the crowd. Always make up your own mind. It is now up to Donald Trump to earn the votes of those in our party and beyond it who did not support him. And I hope he does that. At its best, politics is about bringing people into your cause, not turning them away. And our conservative cause badly needs more people. This is now his time for choosing.
Charlie, I've seen some people within the Republican Party or now out of the Republican Party argue that Haley's campaign was in some ways the last gasp of something you could call Reagan Republicanism. An indication that that's done, and now it's Trump Republicanism or get out. Is there something to that?
I think there's a lot to that. Unfortunately, I think that's a reasonable read. You know, as I listened to Nikki Haley in the final days of the campaign, I was thinking that most of her speeches would have fit squarely within the Republican Party in, say, 2011, maybe even as late as 2015. But you could see that she was selling what the Republican electorate was not buying. I mean, this is Donald Trump's party. There's no question about it. You look at the margins he ran up. Yes, a substantial portion of Republicans voted against him. But I think what you're going to be seeing is the rallying around that we saw back in 2016. The tribal gravity is very, very strong. And I think you're going to see, you know, one Republican elected official after another fall in the line behind Donald Trump. Now, I have to admit that I was somewhat surprised by how aggressive Nikki Haley was in her critique of Donald Trump in the final days of the campaign. But and I, you know, held out a little bit of hope that perhaps she would not fall into line behind Trump. And she has not done so. But I think the pressure is going to be very, very intense on all Republicans now to put party ahead of any qualms they might have about Donald Trump's fitness.
There are questions about Haley voters now. There may not be a lot of them, but there are a lot of close states, Wisconsin included, and where they're going to go. You wrote, Charlie, about polling showing in head-to-heads, Haley did better against Biden than Trump against Biden in polls. Exit polls of Haley voters show a good chunk of them say they wouldn't vote for Trump. Polls aren't votes, but is there enough of that going on that that's a worry for Trump and Republican supporters?
Well, I think this is going to be one of the most important questions of the 2024 election, because these votes are in play right now. And I think one of the things that Nikki Haley was sort of alluding to was whether or not Trump would reach out to those voters, or whether he would continue to say, you're out, we don't need you. We are pushing moderate Republicans, Romney, Nikki Haley type Republicans, out of the party. That's not necessarily a winning strategy. You know, politics should be about addition, not about subtraction. But I think that those numbers are interesting, because in each state, there is a substantial portion of the people that voted against Donald Trump who say that they will not come home. Now, a caveat here, many of them might be Democratic or independent voters mm-hmm. who voted in Republican primaries who were anti-Trump to begin with. Philip Bump makes this point in the Washington Post. But obviously, it's a problem, especially in states like Wisconsin, where, in fact, Donald Trump lost in 2020 because tens of thousands of Republicans, voters who voted for Republicans up and down the ballot, refused to vote for Donald Trump. That was the margin of Joe Biden's victory. And that, you know, that I think will play out again this year when we'll see what the result is.
Charlie Sykes is with us, longtime conservative commentator here in Wisconsin, looking at Super Tuesday and what happens next. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Chris is with us in Menominee. Hey, Chris.
Hi. I just wanted to say, Charlie, we miss you on Bulwark. And second of all, do you think that Donald Trump's strategy here of kind of squeezing people out of the Republican Party will kind of, quote, create a kind of, quote, unquote, normie conservative party? Is that kind of an inevitable end, do you think?
I don't know the answer to that. That's a really good question, because he is clearly trying to squeeze these voters out. And you know, these voters, and I guess I would put myself in the category, are now sort of politically homeless. I don't know that there's going to be a third party. Our politics is very binary right now. It's very difficult to create new parties. So what I think you're going to see is a shifting electorate, people testing out whether or not they're willing to vote with Democrats, whether or not they prefer to write somebody in, or whether or not they're going to sit home. But clearly it may not be 50% of the electorate, but as Nikki Haley said after the New Hampshire primary, 40% is not a small number. I don't know what percent now the disaffected Republicans are, but they are these swing voters who may determine the outcome of the election in November.
Thanks for the call, Chris. Tom joins us now in Madison. Tom, hi.
Good afternoon. I think the fact that our nation has arrived back to this point with a lackluster incumbent and a criminal opponent, you know, vying for our attention is just ridiculous. It's an argument for really a complete scrapping and overhaul and overthrow of our form of government. Everybody has a cell phone. We don't need Congress. We should have direct democracy.
Tom, thanks a lot for the call. Charlie, I don't know if everybody agrees with Tom's solution, but Tom's not alone in the frustration with Biden and Trump again.
Yeah, I mean, that was not a serious suggestion, but there's no question about it that I think that the country does not want another Biden-Trump race. But this is what we have. And if nothing else, Super Tuesday was a reality check. Okay, you know, we need to stop the wish casting or the pretending. It is going to be Biden versus Trump. People may not like it, but that is the choice. And you know, he did characterize it. You know, he described it being between a lackluster figure and a criminal. A criminal. That's a pretty dramatic choice. Those are not the same things. That is not a parallelism. Somebody who is old and forgetful versus somebody who tried to overthrow the government and is facing 91 criminal charges, felony charges, who has been found liable for fraud and has been found liable for sexual assault. These are not comparable deficiencies. So I think there have been a lot of voters who have been in denial that it would come down to this. They were hoping for a unicorn. They were hoping for somebody else to come out and give them a clearer choice. But this is what it is. And I think as a country, we're going to have to deal with it.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Wisconsin's own Charlie Sykes, longtime radio host, political commentator, looking at the results of yesterday's Super Tuesday primaries. Nikki Haley out, suspending her campaign for president. And as Charlie was just saying, it's current President Joe Biden against former President Donald Trump. Join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, your reactions. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Charlie Sykes, longtime conservative talk radio host based in Milwaukee, currently an MSNBC columnist, looking at results from yesterday's Super Tuesday slate of primaries around the country and the Trump-Biden race, as it is now. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Jim is with us in Norway. Jim, hi.
Hi. Hi, Charlie. Say, I have a question for you. You had mentioned that, the Nikki Haley votes, some of them may peel off because they're just not interested in voting for Trump. I wonder if you think that the opposite or the same thing is happening on the Biden campaign from the standpoint of, you know, people not being happy with inflation, people not being happy with the Israeli war. I kind of wonder if this is going to be an election of apathy.
Jim, thanks for the call. And that's something I wanted to bring up, Charlie. We had first in Michigan, now in Minnesota in particular, this uncommitted vote getting a decent chunk of voters on the Democratic side. How big a worry, largely, I think, over the Israel-Gaza situation. How big a worry is that, do you think, for Democrats?
Well, it is going to be a worry for Democrats. Actually, the caller raised, three different points there. Let me just break them down.
Sure.
I mean, number one, will this be an election of apathy? Will voters be so depressed by the choice or so indifferent because you're dealing with two basically 80-year-old guys running against one another? That's a big question, and that will have an impact on turnout. That's a problem for Democrats. Number two, there is that sense that there are, in inflation, the economy has really been an anchor on Joe Biden's popularity. Now, I think things have been improving, but I think that there's still a gap between what the numbers are showing and the so-called vibes. And so, yes, that's a problem. That may get better as the economy improves. And then the third part are the ideological objections, the people who are disillusioned with the Biden support for Israel and what's happening in Gaza. And you are seeing some disaffection in places, especially in places like Michigan. And the danger there is that the Democrats might lose votes to some of the third and fourth party candidates. People like Jill Stein or Cornel West, the far left candidates there. People remember back in 2016 when Donald Trump shocked the world and beat Hillary Clinton in Wisconsin. People looked at the numbers and realized that the number of people that voted for Jill Stein was greater than Donald Trump's margin. So, yes, that has to be a concern for Democrats. But I do think it's going to be one of the questions about whether, as we get closer to November, people are sort of shaken out of their apathy by the stakes, what it would mean to have Donald Trump back in the White House, what it would mean for the rule of law, what it would mean for the culture, what it would mean for our allies, for our place in the world. So I think that the apathy will probably be jolted into, say, greater attention, you know, as we get closer to the election. And then I think that some of the folks on the left are going to have to make the decision whether or not they think their ideological agenda is more important than the existential threat that Donald Trump poses to the country.
Thanks for the call, Jim. Charlie, before we go back to our callers, I wanted to get your thoughts on the Wisconsin Republican Party. We've got ongoing now an effort by Trump supporters, fervent Trump supporters, to recall Robin Voss after mounting a unsuccessful primary challenge to him last time around. You've got Robin Voss, not exactly a moderate Republican. Mike Gallagher, congressman from the Green Bay area, not running for re-election. Again, a conservative Republican, but he was willing to criticize Donald Trump on January 6th. What are you watching for when it comes to Wisconsin Republicans?
Well, those are two really interesting stories, aren't they? And I think that they're indicative of how much division there is in the Republican Party, and how much and how as MAGA moves forward, they're in a sense eating their young. I mean, think about Mike Gallagher. He was one of the bright upcoming stars of the Republican Party, and he looked around him and said, "I don't want to be part of this anymore. I'm out." Think about what that kind of decision means for the Republican bench going forward when your best and your brightest members of Congress decide they're going to hang it up. With Robin Voss, you know, what an extraordinary story. He has done so much to try to appease the pro-Trump MAGA base. You know, he named the former Supreme Court justice to examine the election, wasted more than $1 million on this bogus investigation into the big lie, and yet nothing he has done has satisfied them. So this is part of this ongoing purge of anyone that is not 100% MAGA. Now I see that Robin Voss has taped a video where he's saying he's going to vote for Donald Trump in November, even after everything that Trump has done for him. So this once again tests the proposition about whether or not there's a place for even very conservative Republicans who are not absolutely loyal to Donald Trump and the party, or whether or not they're going to continue to execute purges.
Talking to Charlie Sykes about presidential politics now that it is a Biden-Trump race. Back to your calls now. We've got Francis with us in Caledonia. Francis, hi.
Hi. I'm wondering if Biden chose a more dynamic vice presidential candidate, if that might not energize his campaign. I'm an old white woman, but I find Kamala, progressive, but I find Kamala Harris pretty lackluster.
What do you think, Charlie?
Ooh, that is a tough one, you know, and unfortunately, and I have to say, you know, a lot of progressive listeners don't want to hear this. One of the reasons why Democrats could not move on from Joe Biden to a plan B is there's a widespread sense among Democrats, and I mean Democrats, that Kamala Harris would be a weak candidate in a general election. So to that, in that sense, she's a liability. The problem is that it's very difficult to dump a vice president midstream, you know, especially an African-American woman vice president. That risks antagonizing and alienating a crucial part of the Democratic base, and I just cannot see Joe Biden doing that right now.
Thanks for the call, Francis. Fred joins us now calling from Willard. Fred, hello.
Hi. You guys have kind of touched briefly on, like, the potential consequences of another Trump term, and I guess that was kind of my concern when it came to, like, the Haley voters and people that, you know, I'm not going to vote for Biden, but I'm not going to vote for Trump. But I guess I'm just curious what happens if Trump wins and we don't get to vote in 2028. You know, then what do we do, or what do those voters do? How does that play out?
I don't get to vote because of the consequences, you're saying, Fred, of a Trump presidency?
Yeah, the guy obviously wants to be a strong man in the world stage, you know. So what, you know, gotcha. Nobody can seem to stop him right now. So,
Fred, thanks for the call. Fred, pointing, I think, Charlie, toward a worst-case scenario that he sees with a Trump re-election.
Well, what's interesting about this is that, you know, Trump, you know, part of the difficulty dealing with Trump is not succumbing to complete Trump derangement syndrome, but also understanding exactly the kind of menace that, that he represents. I mean, this is the first president in American history who refused to accept the result of a fair and free election, who did try to overturn that election, who did incite a violent attack on the Capitol. And so the question is, if he gets back into the presidency, what makes anyone think that he will allow a peaceful transfer of power once that term is over? You know, in a Trump 2.0 presidency, what happens if the Democrats win the next presidential election? How will they respond given the culture and given the infrastructure that he would have? And frankly, I don't think that it's out of the realm of possibility that that could be a real challenge. I mean, Liz Cheney has said very bluntly, very directly, that she does not think that he would easily or freely relinquish power if he got it. And I know that raised a lot of eyebrows, but look at what's already happened. Look how we've gotten to where we are at the moment.
Thanks for that call. Charlie, in our last half a minute or so, do you see a future political home for people who consider themselves conservative Republicans, but not Trump Republicans?
Yes. You know, things that can't sustain themselves forever probably won't. But in the short term, I think that they're going to continue to be political orphans. I think many of them will try to make their peace with Trumpism. But I think we've seen what that entails and what they have to give up to do that. So I think it's going to be a long, hard, disillusioning slog for many of us.
Charlie, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again.
Thank you so much.
That's Charlie Sykes, longtime conservative talk radio host for WTMJ in Milwaukee. He's the author of the book, How the Right Lost Its Mind. We talked to him today about what we learned from the Super Tuesday primaries yesterday and his thoughts on the 2024 presidential campaign. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to The Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. There have been on and off talks for an extended ceasefire in the war in Gaza, but each side is holding firm on demands when it comes to hostages and Israel's military presence in the area. In the U.S., President Biden faces growing pressure to promote a ceasefire to help more humanitarian aid get to the region that's been devastated by the war. Over the weekend, Vice President Kamala Harris used the strongest language yet from the Biden administration, calling for an immediate ceasefire.
The threat of Hamas poses to the people of Israel must be eliminated. And given the immense scale of suffering in Gaza, there must be an immediate ceasefire. For at least the next 6 weeks, which is what is currently on the table.
We're checking in on the latest negotiations in Gaza, looking ahead to what could be next. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the war in Gaza, on efforts to promote a ceasefire and bring relief to people trapped in the area? What do you think of the way the Biden administration has handled the conflict and U.S.-Israel relations? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Ishan Tharoor is a columnist on the foreign desk of The Washington Post, where he writes the newsletter and column called Today's Worldview. Ishan, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
I saw as of a couple days ago, Ishan, negotiations are going on with Hamas and mediators, but Israel sitting out at least at some point. What is the latest on even having both parties together to negotiate for a possible ceasefire?
Well, you have these indirect set of negotiations taking place right now in Egypt. There's expectation and desire for some kind of settlement or agreement or truce to take place before the start of the holy month of Ramadan, which is on March 10th. There are some sticking points. There's a lot of distrust and bad blood, of course. But you do have a pretty concerted push by a whole bunch of mediators, including the U.S., including the Qataris and the Egyptians, to get something done.
I want to talk about conditions in Gaza now. We say phrases like humanitarian disaster, things like that. They don't really paint a full picture. What do we know about the scope of suffering right now in Gaza?
Well, you know, if you talk to a variety of aid human rights organizations, humanitarian organizations, UN agencies, they all tell you roughly the same thing, that in terms of the scale, the speed, and the severity of the crisis, there are very few precedents for what we're seeing right now in Gaza. We're talking about a territory where the vast majority of the population has been displaced from their homes, a territory where a good proportion of all the homes are actually destroyed now, a territory that is running out of food on the brink of famine. We've seen a surge now in reports of deaths of children from malnutrition and disease, let alone the continuing airstrikes on densely populated civilian areas. You're seeing a lack of adequate electricity, water. There are a whole bunch of superlatives that we keep on hearing from UN agencies and various organizations. But it is truly, truly desperate. And of course, while we're trying to catalog and track all the ways in which the suffering is compounding, there are real issues with the access to aid that's coming in. Israel, in certain instances, has apparently snarled aid and blocked convoys from getting into certain areas. So you have, as it is, a real catastrophe, and then you have a whole set of circumstances making it worse.
Israel's primary goal, I think it's fair to say, is to destroy Hamas, or at least make it so that Hamas could not launch another attack like the one back in October. Is there any sense that their war in Gaza is accomplishing that, or could accomplish that?
Well, I mean, they've certainly degraded Hamas's capacities, defeated or eliminated or neutralized a segment of Hamas's fighting force, and of course, utterly undermined Hamas's ability to govern this territory that is now so blighted by war. At the same time, you know, it remains to be seen whether, you know, what the Israeli goal is, because you have within Prime Minister Netanyahu's coalition a whole set of actors, including some officials on the far right, who explicitly say that the goal is not just the destruction of Hamas, it's not just the military objective, it's something a bit more total in terms of neutralizing Gaza, perhaps even depopulating parts of Gaza. And that raises all sorts of questions about the legality of this conflict.
And we've seen just in the last couple of days, I think, Ashan, approval of new Israeli settlements in West Bank, contrary to U.S. policy in the area. A lot of international reaction to that. How does the West Bank fit into this puzzle and what's going on there now?
Well, of course, you know, the West Bank, when we don't have wars like this, shooting wars between Hamas and Israel, the West Bank is usually the center of action and tensions. It's where the bulk of the Palestinian population that's not in Israel or Israel proper lives. It's also, of course, the site, as you said, of this really tense and difficult sticking point in the process of trying to create a Palestinian state. You have seen over the past few decades the expansion of Israeli settlements, an expansion that many experts believe contravenes international law, and that this Biden administration itself, you know, ruled recently is inconsistent with international law. At the same time, you've not seen the U.S., including the Biden administration, do very much to stop this expansion of settlements. And certainly, if you think about the past, and certainly, you know, even under Reagan, when Israel invaded Lebanon, or even under George W. Bush, there have been moments when the U.S. has exerted a degree of leverage to and convince Israel to change certain fronts. And the Biden administration is arguably not exerting that kind of leverage right now.
Talking to Ashan Tharoor, columnist on the foreign desk of the Washington Post, looking at the latest news in Gaza, halting efforts to try to get a ceasefire in the next few days before Ramadan. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions for our guest at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Ishad, if we could turn to American domestic politics. It's a presidential election year. We've seen some Democratic protest votes in a couple of Midwestern states, largely over what's going on in Gaza and what people see as Biden favoring Israel too much. How much is the White House constrained by what's going on in an election year here?
Well, it is very clear that there is a constituency in the Democratic base, especially among Arab and Muslim American communities, that is just really outraged by the depth of what they're seeing and the scale of what they're seeing, and the conviction that for all of Biden's efforts to try to restrain Israel's actions and for some kind of truce, that this administration is complicit in a massacre, in what, you know, some instances some people believe is a genocide, and that is it's become a real kind of turning point in the conversation among at least the left of the Democratic Party in this country. And surely your listeners in the Midwest have a better sense of this on the ground than I do sitting in Washington. But in Michigan, it's obviously, given the demographics there, a potential, a really tricky moment for the Biden administration as it hopes to win re-election in Michigan in November. Now, you know, it's interesting to gauge how this White House sees this conflict. You have lots of administration officials in agencies like the State Department or even the DOD who have in private voiced dissents about the way the White House is conducting this. But and there are, you know, I think in many circumstances, frustrated administration officials who believe that if, you know, their opponent, if President Trump was in office, the situation would be even more deplorable, and circumstances would be even more grim for Gaza's population. So it's a tricky political argument to fight. President Biden sees himself as a very staunch ally of Israel. The Biden administration has quietly delivered lots of military aid to the Israelis, even as it tries to restrain Netanyahu. It is hardly an anti-Israeli government, but what you hear from a lot of Biden advisors is that, you know, they are the adults in the room, and a Republican administration would have put its thumb on the scales in a much more detrimental way to the Palestinians than the Biden administration has.
I want to give a listen to former President Trump, now pretty much the Republican candidate for president. Hadn't said a lot directly about Israel and Gaza, but yesterday he called into Fox News. Here's a listen.
You've got to finish the problem. You had a horrible invasion. It took place. It would have never happened if I was president, by the way. As you know, Iran was broke, Brian. They were broke. They had no money for Hamas, for Hezbollah. They were broke. This would have never happened. And for another reason, they wouldn't have done it to me. I guarantee you that.
So not a lot as far as what his policy now would be. But some Republicans have criticized the Biden administration for not being pro-Israeli enough. What are you hearing from Republicans and the possible or the likely Republican presidential candidate?
Well, you know, among serious policy circles, you have Republicans, as former President Trump mentioned in the call, raising the specter of Iran. You know, I think this is kind of a perennial talking point in Washington about the role Iran plays in the Middle East, its support of bad actors, whether it's the Houthis in Yemen, Hezbollah, groups in Iraq, and so forth. And now, of course, Hamas. I think it's an opportunistic thing to bring up. The Biden administration has fundamentally maintained what Trump's approach was. They have not restored the nuclear deal. They've not been able to bring Iran to the table in any meaningful way. Iran, since the Trump administration broke the nuclear deal and reimposed sanctions, Iran has raced toward the possibility of being able to produce a nuclear weapon unchecked. And that is entirely thanks to the Trump administration's actions, not the Biden administration's actions. And it's also incredibly clear, you know, what Iranian role there was in Hamas orchestrating this attack. There are in Hamas, the political wing of Hamas, who did not know about this attack. So it's pretty implausible to believe that there were people sitting in Tehran who had that much understanding what was going to happen. So I think the Iran link is it's there, but it's pretty tenuous. And, you know, it's unclear to me, you know, Trump occupies an awkward space because on one hand, on Ukraine, he's very eager to withdraw U.S. support of a conflict and withdraw U.S. Aid to allies. And then when it comes to Israel, he's singing a very different song. It's deeply, well, what is, of course, very important to recognize is that the Trump administration certainly has a hand in the current overall state of the pretty dismal state between Israelis and Palestinians. The Trump administration, when it was in office, of course, sided entirely and empowered and emboldened the Israeli far right. This, Trump's ambassador, David Friedman, is a kind of supporter of the settler movement in Israel. And it helped create certain political conditions that have exacerbated Palestinian despair and discontent. Sowed the seeds for a lot of the disaffection and anger that we're seeing now.
We're talking to Washington Post foreign affairs columnist Ashan Tharoor about ceasefire negotiations between Israel and Hamas, the latest from the war in Gaza. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guest? What do you want to see from U.S. policy when it comes to boosting a ceasefire in the region? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with Ashan Tharoor, columnist at the foreign desk of the Washington Post. He's with us today to talk about the latest in ceasefire negotiations between Israel and Hamas and where the war in Gaza could go from here. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or questions. Let's go to your calls now. Steve is with us in Madison. Steve, hello.
Yes, hello. I'm curious, the speaker has mentioned that one of a few of the 120 members of the Knesset mentioned destruction of Gaza, but yet the full leadership of the Hamas group has said to repeat this over and over again. Why is that not being discussed? And in that situation, what is Israel's choices at this point? And also the breakdown of the conversation of the recent negotiation. My understanding is that was because Hamas refuses to deliver a list of their hostages that they still hold.
Steve, thanks for the call. Let's take that second point first. The hostages, Ishan, Israel has in fact said, yeah, we want a full list of the hostages still alive and in custody of Hamas. How big a sticking point is that?
Yes, that appears to be one of the major sticking points and a source of frustration for a number of Arab officials that you talk to who are privy to the subject of the talks. Now, look, no one is defending Hamas here. No one, for one second, believes that they are a particularly legitimate or decent institution or organization of people. It is important to recognize, though, that their existence in Gaza for these past few years and for the past decade and has been in certain ways enabled by the right-wing government of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who saw in the kind of entrenchment of Hamas in Gaza, a way to break the Palestinian national movement and maintain a schism there, which foreclosed any further discussion of a political process that could lead to a two-state solution, that is, a scenario where you have independent Palestinian and Israeli states existing side by side. Absolutely, I think there's a kind of universal recognition that Hamas is a bad actor and has to be reckoned with. But the Israeli security establishment has for years had its systems of control in place. And it has for years had a means to keep it in check. And, of course, it has the protocols that exist that unfortunately were outmaneuvered by Hamas's hideous raid on October 7th. But there's no mystery here. And I think when people talk about what's going to come next, they're hoping for a scenario where Hamas is to a certain extent disarmed, to a perhaps even deeper extent brought in or neutral, sort of subsumed within a more functional Palestinian political entity. Now, we don't know what that looks like. There are all sorts of discussions about what that could be. Arab officials hope for some kind of technocratic Palestinian government that could
at least for a transitional period, run Gaza. But given the state of destruction there, given the despair there, given the real angers and hatreds that are now coming to the surface, it's really hard to see a future where Hamas or movements like Hamas that cast themselves as resistance to the occupiers and the oppressors of Israel are going to truly disappear.
Thanks for the call, Steve. Philip joins us now in Black River Falls. Philip, hi.
Yes, I have a comment about the issue in Gaza and other issues of wars around the world. People keep asking the question as to why Mr. Biden doesn't speak out more against some of those issues. And so we have to go back and look at the big picture, and nobody seems to be doing that. We saw the firestorm over Baghdad when America was softening up Iraq. I don't have a side in all this, but we saw that firestorm. Those cruise missiles were being shot from miles away. One of Saddam's cabinet was a practicing Catholic. There were supposed to be other alleged Christians in Baghdad. And we saw that firestorm. We saw the bombing of those people. And so it'd be utter hypocrisy for anyone in America to speak out very strongly against any of the wars that are going on in these other countries.
Philip, thanks for the call. Ishan did, I've seen this argument before, the idea that the U.S. lost credibility in the Middle East after the Iraq invasion. Is there something to that?
I mean, I think if you speak to an average person in the Middle East, that would be true, that the United States launched a war of its choice to topple a regime that it didn't like, triggering a cascading series of calamities and events that brought us to, you know, the emergence of the Islamic State in Syria and Iraq, that so spread instability across the region, that emboldened a pretty terrible regime in Iran. And then that also surfaces in when you have an administration like the Biden administration talking about the rule of law and morality in other contexts, say in Ukraine. So the war in Iraq has been a huge blow to American credibility. It's been constantly brought up as a mark of American hypocrisy, as has, to be clear, the U.S.'s continued support of Israel in certain contexts when it comes to the Palestinians, including in this war and including in its constant defense of Israel and shielding of Israel at forums like the United Nations.
Thanks for that call, Philip. In our last couple of minutes, Ishan, I want to look at Israeli politics, domestic politics. It seems like Benjamin Netanyahu has gotten a lot of blame within Israel for these for the Hamas attack and its and the lack of preparation. Apparently, is there a thought that his days may be numbered as the leader of that country?
If you look at the polling, it seems quite certain that if there was an election tomorrow in Israel, Netanyahu would be booted out of power. But there's not going to be an election tomorrow. Netanyahu is currently, he was in power with the far right government. Now he's at the head of a wartime unity cabinet. And there's a strain of analysis that, especially from Netanyahu's opponents within Israel, that see Netanyahu as somebody who is desperately trying to cling to power through this crisis. And outmaneuver, and he's, of course, somebody who's been in power for so long and is so skilled and such a canny political operator and survivor that he is trying to outmaneuver his opponents here by holding on to his coalition, maintaining this war at a certain level in a certain way, even as, you know, there are a lot of critics in Israel that say Netanyahu is not focusing enough on the plight of the remaining hostages in Hamas, in Hamas captivity in Gaza. They say that Netanyahu is more focused on kind of continuing along kind of an overall war than on the need to specifically free these hostages. There is a sense that maybe he's holding on for November when he may have a much more favorable dispensation back in Washington to call on.
Ishan, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Ishan Tharoor, columnist on the foreign desk of the Washington Post. He writes the Today's Worldview newsletter and column there. He joins us today for a look at the war in Gaza, the latest negotiations for a ceasefire. Some hoping to get that signed by Ramadan in a few days. Looks like the odds might be long. Join WPR Thursday night at 8 for live coverage of the 2024 State of the Union Address. President Joe Biden will deliver the address to a joint meeting of Congress. NPR has live special coverage of that and of the Republican Party response. NPR's Steve Inskeep hosts. Members of the NPR politics team will join the coverage in the studio and from the U.S. Capitol. That's the 2024 State of the Union Thursday at 8 here on Wisconsin Public Radio and at WPR.org. How does Wisconsin like to drink its coffee? There's one big surprise, according to a recent survey anyway. Some kind of insurance settlement company called Coventry Direct did a survey for some reason of coffee drinking habits around the country and rated states by their preferences. I don't know how scientific this was. Wisconsin coffee drinkers go through just shy of 2 cups a day on average. That's pretty normal by national standards. The latest time we'll drink coffee, 1:47 p.m. on average. But here's the weird thing to me. The survey asked people how they take their coffee, including the use of cream or creamer. Wisconsin comes in lowest in the nation. That seems weird. Wisconsin produces a lot of what? Dairy products. I am all about the half and half in my coffee. How do you take your coffee? Let us know. Email ideas at WPR.org. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, more Americans are getting diagnosed with sleep apnea. Two sleep doctors join us now to talk about how to diagnose and treat that condition. That's coming up in a couple minutes. First, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Sarah Hopeful with a story about a musician who played a big role in Wisconsin's musical history.
Drummer Viola Smith was a musical trailblazer and innovator. Known as the fastest girl drummer in the world, her career lasted almost 100 years. Author Dean Robbins took a trip to her hometown in Fond du Lac County to tell us more about this legend.
Mount Calvary has only a few hundred residents, but it produced a drummer of national significance. She was born in 1912, and if you stop modern-day residents on the main drag, they still know her name.
Viola Smith.
Viola Smith's father owned a ballroom in Mount Calvary, and townsfolk showed me where it once stood on Fond du Lac Street. Mr. Smith enlisted his older daughters for the jazzy Smith Sisters Orchestra, featuring trumpet, trombone, and saxophone. By the time Viola was ready to join the family band at age 13, she told the Women in Rock Oral History Project that it still lacked a key instrument.
And he had these 8 girls all play piano, and then he'd put them on different instruments. And I was so lucky to be the 6th one. As a 6th one, I was a drummer.
Young Viola tried smacking the snare and socking the cymbals, and she fell in love with the drums. The Smith sisters went on the road in the 1920s as a rare all-female band at Wisconsin fairs and vaudeville theaters. Viola studied other drummers on the circuit and developed her own flashy way of playing. One by one, Viola's sisters left music for other pursuits. But she yearned to keep playing, even though female instrumentalists were not welcome in most male orchestras. So in 1939, Smith formed her own women's jazz band called the Coquettes to showcase her razzle-dazzle style. She placed her 12-piece kit on a tall platform with a giant tom-tom by each shoulder. This innovation wowed the crowds when Smith rapped out rhythms at blazing speed. To end the numbers with a flourish, she bounced her sticks off a drum head and caught them in midair. Smith's fame spread as a technical marvel, earning her the nickname the fastest girl drummer in the world. In 1940, Billboard magazine splashed her on its cover. She remembers that time with the Women in Rock Oral History Project.
That I was doing something that nobody else was doing, and that's what helped me a lot, I'm sure.
In 1942, men were leaving jazz bands to fight in World War II, and Smith saw a chance to boost women instrumentalists. She wrote an influential article for Downbeat magazine called "Give Girl Musicians a Break." It urged band leaders to hire these overlooked players.
Oh, the girl musicians were so happy about this because I mentioned so many girl names, all the girls I knew. Good musicians.
Smith later toured as a solo act with a spectacular 17-piece drum kit. She even studied classical music at Juilliard and joined the National Symphony Orchestra as a timpanist. In 2000, Lincoln Center for the Arts honored her as a jazz legend. Smith continued to smack her snare and sock her cymbals past the age of 100, defying our conventional view of older women. She died in 2020 at the age of 107, a hero to generations of female instrumentalists who followed her into the music business. It's no wonder people still know Viola Smith's name in Mount Calvary. Who could forget the fastest girl drummer in the world?
It was all fun, but drumming is fun.
Author Dean Robbins of Madison brought us that story on Viola Smith. He's written a children's picture book about the musician, the fastest drummer. Clap your hands for Viola Smith. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Sarah Hopeful.
This is Central Time. Obstructive sleep apnea is a common condition for many Americans. According to some estimates, as many as 30 million people could have it. But a lot of those 30 million may not know they have it. Sleep apnea disrupts breathing at night and leads to poor sleep quality and can lead to other health conditions. But a lot of people go undiagnosed for years. Two doctors who specialize in sleep medicine join us now. They're here to help us understand the risk factors, diagnosis, and treatment for sleep apnea. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have sleep apnea yourself? Was it easy to get diagnosed? Did it take a while? Do you use a CPAP machine at night? How has that affected the quality of your sleep? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Dr. Tarif Smadi is a pulmonologist and sleep medicine specialist with Aurora Healthcare. Dr. Smadi, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, welcome. Thank you for having me.
And Dr. Stacy Ishman is a pediatric ear, nose, and throat doctor and sleep surgeon at UW Health. Dr. Ishman, thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Dr. Smadi, can you give us the basics on sleep apnea, especially this most common kind, obstructive sleep apnea, or OSA? What is going on when we have that?
As you've alluded to earlier, obstructive sleep apnea is a very common condition. It really affects a huge segment of the population worldwide. It's estimated to be around 20 to 30% of the general population in some studies. And it tends to span all the spectrum of ages, from children all the way to the elderly. And obstructive sleep apnea is the most common type of apneas by definition. And basically, there is narrowing of the upper airway, which is the anatomical space starting with the nasal airway all the way to the tongue level behind the tongue base specifically. So during wakefulness, the airway is always maintained open through some muscle groups and toning of that airway through directly controlling it neurologically. However, in individuals who have obstructive sleep apnea, sleep state kicks in, the tone of the airway and the patency of the airway becomes compromised to a level where there is a cessation of airflow sometimes, and that's how the breathing is affected.
And Dr. Ishman, what is that going to look and sound and feel like for that person? What are some of the earliest warning signs that, hey, I might have sleep apnea?
Yeah, so what's interesting about this is it's totally different in adults and kids. I think we're all familiar with the roommate who snores too loud and maybe makes it hard for you to sleep. That's very typical in adults. Oftentimes they may have gasping or pausing in their breathing, and oftentimes morning headaches. They may feel tired during the day. That's really typical for adults. For kids, they might actually be hyperactive. It is the rare child who will tell you that they're tired in the morning. My children will fall asleep swearing that they're not tired. And so it's interesting that it looks different in those two groups, but pausing, gasping, choking, and daytime sleepiness are really, really significant findings for sleep apnea.
And Dr. Samadi, a disrupted sleep, that's bad enough in and of itself. I understand that sleep apnea can raise risks for serious health conditions down the line. What are some of our worries of long-term untreated apnea?
Yes, absolutely. In multiple studies now, it's been confirmed that sleep apnea drives significant risk for cardiovascular disease in general. The strongest link is to elevated blood pressure or hypertension. There are increased risks for cardiovascular events in general, from heart attacks, congestive heart failure, arrhythmias, even the risk for stroke is higher. Not to mention, there are the rare cases where there's sometimes sudden death during sleep due to severe sleep apnea.
Dr. Ishman, suppose somebody comes into the doctor reporting some of these symptoms. What are some of the next steps toward diagnosis?
So one thing I want to add is that in kids, oftentimes it's school performance and some other things. So in adults, I totally agree with everything that Dr. Samadi said. But when you think about next steps, really diagnosis is key. So I think Dr. Samadi mentioned that there's a number of conditions that can cause similar daytime symptoms. It may be that you're looking at hyperactivity, which can overlap with this. And maybe you're looking at congestive heart failure, which can overlap with this. And so a sleep study is really the first thing for us to figure out what's exactly going on with a patient and to differentiate obstructive versus other diseases in terms of sleep apnea.
We are talking about sleep apnea. Dr. Stacy Ishman is with us from UW Health. Dr. Tarif Samadi from Aurora Healthcare. We're looking at how sleep apnea is diagnosed, what it can do to you, and coming up, how we treat it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this the story of your life? Are you or is someone close to you dealing with sleep apnea? What were some of the first signs? What did it take to get diagnosed? Have you found treatment that seems to be helping? Join in now with your experiences or questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Dr. Tarif Samadi from Aurora Healthcare, Dr. Stacy Ishman from UW Health, both sleep specialists. We're looking at the risks of sleep apnea, how it's diagnosed and treated. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you use a CPAP machine? Has that affected the quality of your life? Have you tried a different alternative? What questions do you have about sleep apnea? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring in a caller now. Kay is with us in Madison. Kay, hello.
Hi. I have sleep apnea, and I'm wondering about this new gadget, I guess you could call it. It's called Inspire, and it's implanted in the shoulder, and they said you don't have to wear a mask or anything because you use this instead. What can you tell me about it?
Okay, thanks for the call. Dr. Samadi, let's start with you. I had seen a write-up on this. I hadn't heard of this before, but this implant to treat sleep apnea, what do we know about it?
Yes, the hypoglossal nerve stimulator, as we call it, is an FDA-approved option for a selected group of obstructive sleep apnea patients. So there is a specific criteria that patients must meet in order to be considered for this specific therapy. And while it is effective, the data suggests that there are weight limits. Patients have to be within specific BMI range. There's also specific anatomical descriptions that have to be met based on examination using sedated endoscopy. So it's not for every patient. And CPAP, on the other hand, remains superior and more universal. Now, the specifics about the hypoglossal nerve stimulator, it is a generator that is implanted under the chest wall, typically on the right side of the chest wall, similar to a pacemaker. And the ENT surgeon will connect this generator with the hypoglossal nerve, which sits right under the chin on both sides. We only stimulate one side, typically the right side. And this is activated via remote control that the patient have access to. And when they're ready to fall asleep, they simply turn it on. And electrical stimulation at a very low voltage is delivered to the hypoglossal nerve that controls the largest tongue muscle.
Wow.
And that's how the therapy works, by advancing the tongue in a more forward position, keeping the airway more open.
Okay, thanks a lot for the call. Dr. Ishman, Dr. Somadi referenced the CPAP. Now, some people out there are very, very familiar with the CPAP, probably because they use it every night. For people who aren't, can you tell us a little bit about the CPAP, what it does, what it is?
Sure. Although I will say, I'm actually an ENT surgeon who places Inspire. So,
oh, you do?
It's interesting. Yeah. So, interesting. So,
I'll start with really useful. How common is it since you're doing these surgeries that people are getting that?
Yeah, I think it's actually becoming more and more common. But I think Dr. Somadi's comment that there's a select group where it works the best for is a really good one. And it's people who are in a BMI under 35 and who have between 15 and 100 events an hour of obstructive sleep apnea. And so there are plenty of reasons that CPAP is really, really, really useful. And I think his comment about when you can use it, it is more effective than anything else out there. And so the contrast is really great. I'm also a sleep medicine physician in addition to an ENT. And so I have lots of patients who have come to me for the Inspire, and we've done some procedures, mostly nasal, so that they can breathe better through their nose and use their CPAP more effectively. And about half of people who get a CPAP use it really effectively, and about half have some challenges. And so we work really hard to make sure that that technology works, because it can be very effective. But when it's not effective, something like the Inspire can be really useful if you meet the criteria. And so he made a really good point. You have to make sure that both your sleep study and weight, honestly, make you a good candidate. But it can be really a great salvage therapy, meaning if you can't use some other things like dental appliances or CPAP, it can work great, including in the group with Down syndrome, which is the latest group that's been approved for its use.
And Dr. Ishman, I want to stay with you in surgery for a moment. I, as a teenager, had deviated septum surgery. It wasn't the most fun few weeks of my life, but is that something that we do to help with some cases of apnea?
So most of the data shows that if you do nasal surgery, like a deviated septum, or there's bones in our nose called turbinates, which we can make smaller,
yep,
that is really effective in helping us use CPAP better. There is some pediatric data that suggests if you do that surgery, you can reduce the number of pauses an hour you have by up to 10 events an hour. And there's an adult meta-analysis that also suggests up to 11 events an hour, but most adults have far more than that. And so we don't really characterize sleep surgery as nasal surgery. We think it really helps use CPAP for people who don't have sleep apnea, but actually just snore, can really reduce snoring. So it can make your spouse much happier or your friends who live with you. But it is predominantly something that we use to make it easier to use other therapies.
Let's go back to our callers. Kathy is with us in Chippewa Falls. Kathy, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to share, it took a while for me to convince my husband he needed a sleep study, but his snoring would rattle the windows and kept me awake. And I did notice that he would stop breathing. He finally got one, and it's made a world of difference. The snoring is gone. And the one thing that we didn't expect to happen was he used to get up and go to the bathroom maybe three or four times a night. And that stopped. So we are both now getting a full night's sleep, and it's fabulous.
And does he, and I guess you too, Kathy, feel better in the daytime too because of that?
I love it. Yeah.
Kathy.
Yeah, I'm so happy that he finally went ahead with it.
Thanks so much for sharing that. I have some relatives who do CPAP, Dr. Samadi. It can be a real life-changing event when you get this thing, right?
Oh, absolutely. It's like you described, it is a life changer. And the majority of CPAP users, when they are able to tolerate it, they report improvement. And that, of course, is subjective and varies tremendously between different patients. But in general, the outcome is always excellent.
Thanks again for the call, Kathy. Dr. Isman, you work with kids. I imagine it might be difficult at the early going to get a kid to adjust and be willing to wear that CPAP. What does it take to make that happen?
You know, I'm going to be honest. I think we just worry they're going to be hard doing it. the compliance rate in kids is pretty much the same as the compliance rate in adults. And in fact, in kids with Down syndrome, it's slightly higher than it is in adults. So it turns out our kids listen to us. Don't tell my kids. They don't listen to me. But what really I think happens is it's about the attitude of the caregiver. So if you're optimistic about it working, I think you're much more likely to get kids to be able to use it.
Excellent. Now, are there lifestyle changes, Dr. Samadi, that we can do maybe for a milder apnea condition that doesn't rise to the level of a CPAP? Are there sleep hygiene things that we can do that might make a difference?
Yes, absolutely. Some of the tips we tell our patients to do is always emphasize the benefit of weight loss. While this is a difficult goal to achieve for a lot of people, but it's still useful. Even if it's few pounds, it can make a big difference in the severity and the burden of snoring and apnea. Also, avoiding sleeping supine or on the back, that is also very protective, because when we are on our backs, we're more prone and vulnerable to obstructive sleep apnea. So sleeping side, favoring a side is also helpful. And the last thing that I can add is we tell patients to try to sleep with the head of the bed slightly elevated. That also reduces the gravity effect on the tongue, allowing for more open airway.
And Dr. Isman, just a half minute left. Can you give some encouragement to people who might be on the fence of whether they should get that sleep study?
No, absolutely. I think that the most important thing is to understand what's going on. So if you're snoring versus sleep apnea, very different options for treatment. Figure it out, whether it's your partner that you're poking to get out of bed or your child who you're worried is not doing as well in school. I think it's really critical to understand what's going on with their sleep. So thank you so much for giving us the time to talk.
And thanks to both of our guests. We've been talking to Dr. Stacy Isman, pediatric ear, nose, and throat doctor and sleep surgeon at UW Health, and Dr. Tarif Samadi, pulmonologist and sleep medicine specialist at Aurora Healthcare. Been talking about sleep apnea, how it's diagnosed, how it can affect us, and various kinds of treatment. Still time for you to share your story. If you have one, you can email ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, young and old, men and women, there are big divisions in the way we vote. Dig into the age and gender gaps in American politics and what it all means in this election year. And can you put a price on your family's best friend? A Wisconsin economist looks at the value of our canine companions in the new book, Dog Economics, Perspectives on Our Canine Relationships. That and more tomorrow here on Central Time.